From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Stand-up comedy is blossoming around southeastern North Carolina. Comedy enthusiasts can now catch comics in the act at local breweries, arts events, and theatrical venues. But while the arts scene flourished in the Cape Fear region, it was only less than 10 years ago that Wilmington's one full-time comedy club opened. It started as Nut Street Comedy. It's now known as Dead Crow Comedy Room on Front Street in downtown Wilmington. And if you exclude Myrtle Beach or Raleigh, it's the only dedicated comedy club in the area. Today, we'll take a look at the growth of stand-up in the Cape Fear region, what it's like to be a comedian in a smaller market, and how the industry is changing. Timmy Sherrill is a comedian, actor, and co-owner of Dead Crow Comedy Room. Timmy Sherrill, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Lou Morganti is a local comedian who performs around the area, including at Dead Crow Comedy Room. He also produces a monthly comedy show at Waterline Brewing Company called Gruff Goat. Welcome to the program, Lou Morganti.
Thanks for having me.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation during the live Wednesday discussion. Do you want to try out a joke and get some professional feedback? Do you have a question about the local comedy scene? Have you caught either of these guys on stage? Call us during the live show at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Timmy Sherrill, why do you do this? And why has stand-up comedy become such an important part of your life?
Well, I do the comedy part of it just, I think, as most start out, that we watch television or we go to shows, live venues, and we think, you know, I can do that. I can. That's something I've always wanted to do. It's been tugging at me for years, and so you eventually hop up on stage. And
when was the first time you hopped up on stage?
Probably 12 years ago. It was here in Wilmington at
Juggling Gypsy
on Castle. So they had an open mic, and nervously went down to sign up, got in my car, nervously didn't want to do it, drove home, sat in the driveway for 20 minutes.
You signed up and then you left? You
I
drove
did.
Home?
It was that
you chickened out?
It was that terrifying. Absolutely. It was just, and this is years of wanting to do it. Years of, because my sister and I are latchkey kids. We grew up, you know, watching all the comedy shows on television, Sanford and Son, Good Times, you know, whatever else was on in the 70s and the 80s. And then, so it was tugging at me, and I still, you know, terrified, went home, sat in my driveway for 20 minutes and told myself if I didn't do it, I'd regret it, you know, forever. And so never did get out of my car. So I drove back to the Gypsy, jumped on stage, did 3 minutes, which seemed like forever.
Three minutes is actually a lot of material if you're new.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely.
And do you remember any of those early jokes?
I do actually still pull them out. Yeah, I sure do.
Okay. Well, I'll ask you about those in a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe you can
Yeah, so anyway, so I do it just because I'm an entertainer and I'm also an actor. And it was another way for me to kind of what I thought would be to come in the side door of the industry and become a professional actor. And they hold nothing together. So, you know, the one thing that's helped me is my timing. You know, thousands of hours on stage. When I audition now, I can hear the timing. I have an advantage as far as the timing goes.
Right. Lou Morganti, how long have you been a stand-up comic? And when did you know that this was something you wanted to do?
I think as a child, I knew I loved it. My father was a huge comedy fan. So I just remember as a child, probably too young to watch some of the comedy specials that I watched. But I got to watch George Carlin. I got to watch Sam Kinison. At the time, you know, Bill Cosby was, you know, his special had first came out, and Bill Cosby himself was just on TV. So I remember watching my father's reaction to that and always saying, I want to get that reaction. So I lived in New York for many years and never did it. I waited until I was here in Wilmington.
What did you do when you were in New York?
Just worked. I mean, I've always wanted to do it. I just never figured out how to do it. Of course, New York's the biggest comedy place. You can do things. And, of course, I ignored that for 32 years.
When you say just worked, what work did you do in New York?
I've done, you name it. I've done electrical work. I've done call center work.
Why did you go there in the first place?
Into New York?
Yeah.
Well, I lived in New York. So I moved down here. See, I moved down here with a job about 15 years ago, and then I did comedy. I started 8 years ago this month. I went down to, at the time it was Nutt Street. A friend had convinced me to go down to check it out, and I went for a month straight of open mics and never went on stage. I was too scared to sign up. And then finally I signed up, and I haven't stopped since that first time I went on stage. It's one of those things that when you do it, you just know you want to keep doing it. And it's been fulfilling. There's been times it's been very fulfilling. Then there's very big disappointments in it as well. But it's just, if you're not on stage for a while, my wife tells me all the time, why don't you go to an open mic or something and blow off some steam? Because she knows it's just been sitting in me that something needs to come out. So it's just something in you once you know you have it.
So talk about those moments, because both of you say that you were terrified before you jumped up on stage the first time. Do you still get scared? And are there moments that you've been on stage and you've just walked into a deep, dark pit and fallen off the edge? Like, why is it so scary? What happens?
Well, there's just a bundle of nerves for me anyway. I can only talk about what happened to me, but that would come over me. And that happened for a couple of years probably of just being off to the side of the stage and I'm next up. And it's almost like a panic attack in a way, a mild panic attack. I was just trying to remember my first joke. I figured, that's how nervous I would get. Like if I just could get that first joke out word for word, like I wrote it, then I wouldn't have a problem for the rest of the time up there.
The fear is, what if I get out there in front of the microphone and then forget everything I have to say?
Almost for me, like I didn't want to forget my material. I didn't want to do a bad job either, from what I had written. And I don't know, you can define whatever that bad job is for you in that moment. But and then after a while, as in a panic attack, it creates more panic. And so, it's just it's like a snowball effect. But then after a while, a few years later, that I just didn't get nervous anymore. And I don't get nervous at all. If there's a change sometimes in like what you're expecting, because a lot of times as a comic, you'll get in a car and you'll drive, 2.5 hours because the promoter says there's 300 people here. And then you get there and there's 10, which is a super common thing. And so that curveball, there's always a curveball, but that curveball will kind of throw you in a little cycle. But
so how do you handle people not laughing at your jokes? Because that has to be part of the deal for any comic ever. Lou.
Yeah. No, I mean, that happens often. Sometimes you try material out and you find out that it's just not ready yet. It's not ready for prime time. And, that's the good thing about open mics when you go to places that you can try out new material and work through things, because if you write a bit on paper and go and perform it perfectly the first time, you're some kind of genius and you should have all your specials taped. But it takes you a long time to take those words and actually make it a joke, because, just a change of words can make a difference. Just a pause before you say the next part of it can make a huge difference.
Can you give us an example of a joke that you had to kind of tweak with either a pause or a different word? Mm-hmm. Because, Timmy, in your interview with our Coastline producer, you talked about this as a very pure form of the spoken word. And I think a lot of people who don't do this probably don't imagine the precision that this art form requires. Mm-hmm. So what's an example of that?
I had a joke about me eating a Kentucky Fried Chicken. It was just a joke about me getting a bad batch of chicken. And I remember the first time I tried the joke, it fell completely flat. and it didn't work. And this was like the first real joke that I thought I wrote thoroughly. And I went back and I was going to throw it out. I thought, nobody likes it. Let me throw it out. And then I took it and I rearranged it into a story. And I took it and just broke it apart. And it went from probably a 2 or 3 minute joke to a 9 minute bit. That goes that long. And the idea about just laying it out slower and making it more about the whole situation, that made it pop. But it took a long time to do that.
So we have 2 minutes before we go to break. Can you give us a little bit of that, or it doesn't not work in
well,
this format?
I mean,
take a shot.
I mean, I could. Well, basically, the situation is that I had gone to Kentucky Fried Chicken and got myself dinner, and I ordered a family meal. And the thing about me is I'm not a family. It was 8 pieces of chicken, 4 biscuits, and a bucket of mashed potatoes just for me. And basically, in the bit, I go in, I get home. I change into my eating clothes because those are your clothes that you don't care about getting food on.
Because sweatpants.
We have it, right? We all have that, okay? And I realized that they shorted me a piece of chicken. And I took it out on Kentucky Fried Chicken's social media. And they ended up blocking me from social media. So that was the basic of the bit.
Okay. Thank you for that. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of the comedy scene in the Cape Fear region. Timmy Sherrill of Dead Crow Comedy Room and comedian Lou Morganti are with us today. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can reach us via email on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org. You can also call us during the live discussion at 910-343-1138. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a look today at how the stand-up comedy scene in Wilmington started and how less than a decade after the first comedy club opened, this art form is growing in a smaller market. Timmy Sherrill, co-owner of Dead Crow Comedy Room, and Lou Morganti, a local stand-up comedian, are with us today. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. Maybe get some professional feedback on a joke that you want to try at an open mic night coming up soon. Or you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Give us your best one-liner. So Bill from Wilmington called in, and he asked about handling comedy in these politically charged times. And that's a question I think a lot of comics are having to deal with. We recently had Paula Poundstone in here talking about how just a couple of years ago she was on stage at the Wilson Center and somebody got up in the front row and dropped the F-bomb screaming at her and walked out, made a big show of it. It was really shocking for her. Hmm. But does that happen these days with you? Do you shy away from political comedy? Is it more divided than it's been, Timmy?
Unfortunately, and I use the word unfortunately because I feel like it shouldn't affect my set, but I do filter my material. So even in writing, or I'll write a joke, and I have a different. I tried to be the person that would sit down and at a coffee shop and write out, you know, things word for word. And I did that for years at first, and it just didn't work for me. And now a lot of times my subconscious is writing my jokes. And then in whatever situation I'm in, something will happen, and my subconscious will spit it out to me, and it's pretty much fully written, which is an unusual way to write jokes. And most of my best jokes are the ones that they're already done. I didn't even know they were going on until I was made aware of it.
But you do filter yourself.
I have jokes that I've written and I've never told. And I think they're great, but I've never told them. And it's due to, you know, it is due to the politically correct environment that I'm living in. And I don't want to, and I came to a conclusion years ago, maybe months ago or a couple years ago, but I don't want to offend anyone on behalf of me succeeding.
It's bigger than you as a comic because you're co-owner of a local club that needs to work.
And that has to.
You don't want to alienate people from the club.
The co-ownership of the club is also another variable for me personally because I do have to make it a safer environment for people. It's weird because I don't really consider myself an owner of anything. I consider myself a comic. And that's where I run into most of my difficult. That's usually when I have a problem with an audience member or feedback or something. It's because I don't think on those lines. I don't think on ownership lines. I think I'm an entertainer. I'm a comic, and this is true to me. This happened in my life experience, and it's hard to tell a joke on your life experience and then someone judge you for it based on the fact that I shouldn't have had that life experience, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
So I want to ask you about specifics now, because, you know, what's interesting about this question, I think, is if we talk about presidents, every single president since there's been stand-up comedy and since there have been American presidents has been the subject of jokes. But something shifted. Was it before the last presidential election that it shifted and it became dangerous territory and people would get deeply offended? When did it shift?
Well, I personally feel like it's based on whatever the topic is. Because there's political humor, and so you're going to have offense in politics, and there's racial tension. You're going to have offense there, and there's I don't give you an innocent example. When I was in ninth grade, I had to go to summer school because I plagiarized a story, and I did it. I barely graduated high school. Let's put it that way. I was 243 out of 248 in my class,
that's its own kind of accomplishment.
But I had to go to summer school for plagiarism, and I made the joke on stage, and an English teacher did the same thing. Paula Poundstone did, or Paula, the fan at Paula Poundstone, she jumped up, made this huge scene, you know, scolded me in public for plagiarism. And my comeback was, this was 1970, you know, in the 70s. We didn't have copy and paste. You should actually be proud of me for being able to plagiarize by hand, you know. And then it just completely derailed. But so just as something as simple as...
So she got emotionally involved in that. Well, that doesn't even sound like a political issue to me.
An English teacher with... Yeah, plagiarism. Yes, I got where she was coming from. But so I would say take that same context, but put it in any genre,
I don't know if there was necessarily a shift with this administration. I think there's always been a political humor, right? There's always been that to kind of poke fun at the administration and things like that. And I think... as people got more politicized on their personal lives, I think that stuff started to rise to the top of, I don't want to hear a differing of opinions.
When did you start to notice that, Lou Morganti, as a comedian?
I would probably just say probably in the last I wouldn't say it was one particular time. I think it slowly worked its way in of that, but I think a lot of society has changed too. When people talk about jokes, there's punching up and punching down, right? So you want to punch up to, you know, when you're making jokes, you want to make fun of somebody that's either above you or on your same level. You don't want to punch down on groups that are already downtrodden or have issues, right? Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that started to see that when people were punching down, people were like, no, And it used to just go. People used to ignore it. Like, I'm just not a fan of that person. Now it becomes a point where you're saying, I'm going to boycott whatever they're part of. I think you start to see that. And I think that's as society changes and things like that happen, you tend to see things like that. And I think as people become more identified as left or right, that's what you start to see coming out. That they don't want to hear that, you know, that part of it. Like, I don't find myself as a political humorist. I don't talk about politics. Are there some things that sneak in there that talk about what's going on in this country and how I feel about it? Absolutely. But I don't know if somebody sat down and said, you're a political comedian. I try to keep that stuff out of there, but, you know, every now and then it just slides in because it works, A, for the humor, and B, it's kind of what I believe in. And then there's a little bit about, you have to understand that when people go onto the stage, it's an act.
Right.
It's not right. necessarily when you come off stage, you're that person. Sometimes you just write in that character, just like you're doing a poem. You may write in a different voice of a different person. It doesn't mean you are that person. And that sometimes people have to let go of that aspect of it too.
Timmy.
And on that, I've always said that comedy is 99% truth, something that did happen, and 1% absurdity. And then it's the absurd thought that I think all of us, I'm going to generalize, I believe all of us have it, whether we're at a cocktail party or we're at work or we're riding in a car and we see something, you have this, at least I do, I have this voice inside my head that will see something, analyze it, and then spit something out about it. You know, a judgment in a way, if you will. Sometimes the judgments are funny. And then those are the absurdities that I put in my – that's so that 1% absurdity, which is my punch for the joke, or is the thought that I have that I'm trying to translate to you now to make you associate to it and laugh, is that absurdity. And that's where a lot of people get really, really on edge as an audience member. And most audience members are wonderful. Mm-hmm. They know what they're getting.
Absolutely.
And like I said, you know, before in the pre-interview too, no one's trying to make you angry.
Right.
There are like a handful of comics in the world that love that. Mm-hmm. I need you to accept me.
Yeah.
For my own self-esteem.
I couldn't be a comic that wasn't liked. Like, mm-hmm. there's comics out there that just want to be hated. That's great for them.
But you're saying most of them are people-pleaser types?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They want to make you feel good. They mm-hmm. want to make you laugh.
You've never – when you see a comic come off stage and you've seen a show and you see about three-quarters of the room holding their sides from laughter,
mm-hmm.
That comic is going to come off stage and be like, did you see that quarter of the audience that didn't laugh at my jokes?
Right.
And that's just how it is. And that comic will – even you can say you've made – you know, 75 people laugh. Yeah, but 25 people didn't. And that's all they see in there. And, you know, and the thing about offensive humor and things like that, we all have that in us. There's, you know, the gallows humor where it gets dark. And we've all had that situation. We've been at a funeral with maybe some friends or family members, and someone makes a joke. And it's not an appropriate time or place to make a joke, but you laugh. Because they made that joke. That is just human nature. And, you know, sometimes you have to go to those dark places and make a joke just so you can survive. And, you know, you see that a lot. And I think a lot of times if people understand that, sometimes things are written in that voice and not necessarily meant to offend.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the comedy scene in the Cape Fear region. With us to answer your questions on this Wednesday, Timmy Sherrill, he's a comedian and co-owner of Dead Crow Comedy Room. Lou Morganti is a comedian, and he produces a monthly comedy show at Waterline Brewing called Gruff Goat. You can ask your own question or try out your own one-liner during the live discussion by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Hari Kondabolu was here kind of recently, and he was appearing at Dead Crow, and he talked about how Apu, the Indian character mm-hmm. on The Simpsons, was problematic, and it had been problematic his whole life, but white people were just now kind of waking up to that, which Lou Morganti kind of goes to your point about punching up, not punching down, and white male comedians starting to recognize all of these other marginalized groups that maybe you did used to make fun of. Timmy, have you had an evolution on that front? I mean, when you look at your comedy from when you started to now, are there groups that you might have poked fun at before and you've kind of gone not funny anymore?
Maybe not groups, stereotypes. Mm-hmm. I've become more aware of like not offending someone in order to succeed. And whether that's just to succeed for that 30 seconds of a joke, I've tried to fit that in. But I grew up in the 60s and 70s here in North Carolina, and I'd say even liberal from 3 years old, as far as I can remember. So I've always felt I've felt like there's no difference between me or anybody else on the planet. And so just trying to figure it out like everybody else, and then, just dealing with the foundation when I arrived. I've always just felt like accepting of everyone. Mm-hmm. So for me, I haven't had to do a lot of transitioning, but I have stopped saying jokes that I look back and I go, that was funny, and it works every time, and people love it, and I could do it for the rest of my life, but is it worth it?
Right. But Aziz Ansari, for instance, is a really interesting example, I think, of this.
Right.
It was more than a year ago now, a couple years ago, that he was accused by a woman of she felt she was forced into sex, mm-hmm. with him. So it was his own kind of Me Too moment. And mm-hmm. publicly he said he was shocked by it and he didn't see that situation as that way. So his recent Netflix special, he spends a lot of time, he apologizes first and talks about how thoughtful he's become. And then he spends time talking about his evolution and how everybody changes all the time and you see things differently, Lou Morganti. How have things changed for you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. When you look back at some things, there has been material that I used to do that, looking back now, I can see that it could be considered problematic. And, it's something that you need to understand. You want to be on the right side of history when something comes down. So, if I ever had the chance to ever record an album, I'd love for somebody to listen to it 20 years from now and be like, those jokes are still funny. And I'm a comic historian. I've watched comedy since I was a little kid. So I listen to comedy through my whole life. Sometimes I listen back to some of the comics that I loved as a kid and I went, oh, there's a problem with that now.
And can you give us an example of that?
You can go back and I'll use the example. Sam Kinison was a very, it's very out there comic. And some of his material is misogynistic. And you look back at now, when I was a kid, him yelling and screaming and being that. But then I look back now and I'm like, okay, he could have still made those points differently. But, he's not here to defend that. Sometimes you look at like the comics now, like Jeff Dunham, he has a terrorist puppet in his act. It doesn't fit anymore. That's a stereotype that he's playing up for, and he's literally punching down on a group of people that they already have their own issues. They don't need the white guy making fun of it and making it worse, right? So that's a situation where you look at and you go, okay, that needs to evolve and change, at some point. But does the guy sell out stadiums when he goes? Absolutely. So it's going to take time for society to figure that out. And you hope that people have that moment in themselves and go, okay, I'm going to be on the wrong side of history. And, will there be a day that maybe someone comes back to me and says, hey, what you said then offended me. And I'll apologize for it if I feel like, that was, offensive and things like that. But I hope I'm not on that side. But I think, you just live life. And as you evolve and learn things and you get more experience in life, you're going to change and things are going to sound different.
Do you find that those concerns cause you to take fewer risks than you might otherwise take? I mean, this is an art form, and, mm-hmm. and part of making art is taking a risk and often falling on your face and being willing to do that and try it again. Mm-hmm. Timmy, Cheryl.
Yeah, for me, I like making people laugh, but I've always wanted to make a statement or to say, you know, to teaching moments, if you will. And I have jokes that are, I feel like are teaching moments to break down barriers, and they're not always well accepted.
Can you give us an example of one of those?
Yeah. I have a joke where I discuss where my theory on where different colored skin comes from. And it's just this angel in heaven that is can't get anything right. I base heaven on a successful company. It has human resources department. It has, product quality assurance. And he keeps getting thrown from department to department, and he keeps getting everything wrong. But my point is everything's right. He made different color people, but it's right. He didn't mess up. And so it is not always.
Have you offended people with that joke?
Absolutely.
And what do they say? What's their complaint about it?
It usually falls back on they don't want to discuss racism anymore, basically. It's over. We should move on.
White people.
Yes.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the stand-up comedy scene in the Cape Fear region. You can ask your own question of Timmy Cheryl of Dead Crow Comedy Room and comedian Lou Morganti either by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org or by calling us at 910-343-1138 during the live Wednesday show. When we come back from this short break, you'll have one more segment to get your question or your one-liner in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The Cape Fear region is rich with local arts, creative writing, poetry, film, theater, music, visual arts, and stand-up comedy. But that last form is relatively new to southeastern North Carolina. Today we're learning about how it got its start here and how local comedians stay sharp. Timmy Cheryl is a comedian and co-owner of Dead Crow Comedy Room. Lou Morganti is a local comedian and produces a monthly show at Waterline Brewing called Gruff Goat. They're taking your questions during the live Wednesday show. You can email us today at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or your comment in. Gary from Wilmington called and wants to know if comedy rests upon the individual uniqueness of the performer, is comedy just an audible character of the person on stage?
Yeah, I think it's more of an amplified version of somebody, right? So, when I'm on stage, I'm me, but it's an pushed version of me, more amplified. You know, like most of my stories that I do as jokes are true stories, but I punch them up into their humor. Like there's some parts of it that I pushed forward and change a little bit to make it more, make it funnier, to help the through line of the bit go through. So I think there's a little bit of everybody. Now, there are comics that are just strictly characters, character driven. Neil Hamburger is a great example. He is an anti-comedy comic.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so he will go up on stage and he'll in the middle of his bit just start clearing his throat. So he's just and just stop a bit in the middle and just go on to something else. And you're just like, what's happening? But that's his character. Is this just awful. Like he looks like he's got a comb over, and he just looks slovenly. And then his jokes come off, and he's like, you know, clearing his throat in the middle of it. But that's it. And there's a huge group of people that love him. But there's some people that go to see a show. They're like, I'm going to see a comedy show, and they walk out, and they're just like, I'm not satisfied for what happened. And that is literally it's the comedy experiment. You know, can this be funny for some people and not funny for others?
So women comics are populating the scene much more than they ever have. This used to be the domain of pretty much white men, mostly men. And I've heard people say, I've heard them say out loud, women are not as funny as men. Is that true, Timmy, Cheryl? How is that changing? What are you seeing?
I think it goes back to what we were saying, where we're all trying to evolve and break down stereotypes. I see, because we as a club book a lot of female comedians. I'm even told that by agents and managers from LA when I call and I request people, and you know, they'll say to me, you know, you guys are really, you know, friendly to female comics.
So there are clubs then that aren't, is what you're saying?
Yes, I think so. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be saying, and they make it a point to kind of let me know. But it's almost like I book the club, and I book funny people. I don't care who you are. I have doors to keep open, so I want, you know, whatever you do when you get here, by all means, it's an uncensored room. You be you, but I need comics to make people have fun for an hour and a half and want to come back. I don't put people on stage for you not to have a good time when you come down. And if you don't have a good time and you address that, we try to address that back, and we try to listen and figure out, you know, what it is that you didn't have fun at.
Why do you think it's taken longer for women to kind of come into the scene?
Well, I think more women are feeling the ease of doing it. I feel like I think they've always been trying to be successful in this genre. And I think they've just like, you know, women in business or women in politics, there's a pushback that they've come up against.
So it's the same barrier then that they would find in any
same,
other sector.
Sure. But for whatever reason, there's an added variable that people feel like they're not going to be as funny, which, you know, I would like to address in that absolutely they are just as funny. If sometimes they're funnier than the male comic that was there the week before, or the male comic that's opening up for them.
Why do you think that perception is out there? Because I've heard that mm-hmm. from people, Duncan. I've heard people say, you know, maybe it's not that they're not as funny, but maybe we just don't relate as much to the feminine experience, which is, to me, absurd considering that's half the population.
Right. And I think it goes back to, like, you know, for me anyway, as a man, I would just try to analyze it and figure that out. Same, because when I'm booking, I'm like, why are people not buying tickets for this weekend when they bought tickets for the last show? I think it's they don't want to really take a chance because it's a female comic that they see on my webpage, which I'm here to say, take the chance. Take the opportunity. Here's the secret to comedy. I've always said it. If you can make all the women in the room laugh, then the whole room's laughing because their spouses and boyfriends feel at ease to laugh with them. If you shut down the females in the room, watch how fast a room gets silent and watch how bad a show goes. So if there's female comics on stage, why wouldn't female audience members show up in droves to support those female comics? But they're just as funny. And I think it's males, and here I'm going to generalize again, probably going to get pushback on it, but we have a sense of what women are, and I have a theory on this as well, if anybody wants to hear it.
Uh-oh.
It is a very simple theory. We grow up separated. Men learn their rules. Women learn their rules, which are very catty and aggressive with each other. And then we come together, and then men and women can't figure out why we don't understand each other.
Wait a minute. Okay, so mouths just dropped open in the adjacent studio. So women are catty with each other? They're taught to be aggressive and catty with each other?
No. I think both genders are.
Yeah, both genders are. We're catty in more of a physical way, yeah. And women more catty
The rules of how a man grows up and a woman grow up, and, you know, there's rules within that, and then you throw them together, and those rules don't necessarily match.
Does anyone
each
have
other.
A shovel?
I don't think he was making the point that it was that's catty. I think, you know, men are taught, you know, you got to be better than that person, and the women, you know, and then you put those groups together, and that's a struggle. I mean, you know. Women, for the longest time, I mean, they're always been behind the eight ball on things like, you know, in the workplace and things like that. That took a long time to evolve.
You're talking about the external barriers imposed on them, not
right. Yeah,
and women are behind the eight ball.
Not right. That's what I mean. Like right. That, you know. So they've always had to fight for it. And I think, you know, you're look at stand up comedy overall. It's like you said, very male dominated, yeah. Right? And then you look on a road comic is just by himself or herself on the road, right. Traveling around this country. You don't know where you're going, so I can see how that's intimidating. That's intimidating for me. I can imagine what it would be like for a woman, a single woman, to just go on the road in a car, going to a city she doesn't know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that might have something to do with it too, mm-hmm. But. Some of my favorite comics are female comics. They're brilliant, and sometimes we go to a show, and I'm so excited to see them on stage, and I look and I look at empty rows, and that to me is sad because people are missing out on that because they're like, oh, you know, they have that generalization that they're not going to be funny, they're not going to enjoy it, but it is just it's not true. It's like Timmy was saying, take a chance, go see. Go see a comic that's outside of what your norm or somebody you see on Netflix or HBO or whatever you see it on. Go and I guarantee you'll have a much better time than you thought.
So just for fun, if you're talking to some people right now who really think that women aren't as funny, throw out the name of a female comic whose Netflix special they should watch or who they should check out.
Check out Jen Kober. She's brilliant. Sarah Schaefer, Nikki Glaser. Maria Bamford, Tig Notaro. There are just so many brilliant people out there that you can just go and see and enjoy. And just, Jenny Zringo. I guarantee if you watch any of those specials, I'll put this out there. If you watch those and you hate them, send me an email. Okay, and okay. I'll tell you that you're wrong.
Lou Morganti. They can find you at loumorganti.com, right? So Mike writes, just finished up an improv class here in Wilmington with Daredevil Comedy. I haven't laughed like that in a long time, even with my job as an at-home dad. This class opened up the possibility of getting involved in comedy here in Wilmington, something I never thought possible. Can't wait to come out to Dead Crow soon and join the local comedy scene. It's so much fun. Smiley face. Thanks, Mike. When do you have open mic nights, Timmy, Cheryl?
Open mic nights have always been, since the beginning of this, has been Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. If you or you know someone that wants to sign up, we've never closed down the list. There, you can come out and sign up between 7 and 7:30. And then if there's 40 people on the list, we let all 40 people go up.
Whoa.
And then typically it's a packed out show, audience members and comics.
It's a rare open mic where there's actually a lot of audience members.
Right.
We don't have that, and it's a rarity that it is here, and it's here in Wilmington, and it's packed out. So it's a real great place to mm-hmm. start.
And there's no cover charge.
Okay.
And it costs nothing to sign up. You don't have to bring 10 friends. Which is unusual in comedy clubs.
So if there are 40 people who sign up, the only way people would get bumped is if Seinfeld showed up.
No, we wouldn't. No, we'd still wouldn't not bump. And for... matter of fact, if Seinfeld shut up, he'd get the same 4 minutes as everybody else.
I've always done that.
I've
seen comics drop in on Thursday nights because they're coming through to another city, and they go up. They do the same exact time as open micer, and then they get back in their car, and they head, and it's nothing different.
Wow, so. That's a different business model than some of the major clubs in major cities, right? Timmy, Cheryl?
Yeah, I've always been a little.
We have John Kelly from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, John. You're on the air.
Oh my goodness, I'm scared. You talk about religious jokes. You really got to watch out because they're very sensitive, right? So what I do with my non-believers, we talk about the Big Bang Theory. It's a big deal. And then I say to them very quietly, yeah, but who lit the match?
All right. That's great, John. Okay. Thank you so much. who lit the match?
Right. That's a really good example of someone that now that's all. I don't know if anyone's ever said that before, but that's literally laying right there on the table, and it just takes somebody with the thought to pick it up and use it. And it's like that right there, because I know the Big Bang. I've heard about it. Yeah. But I've never thought that there was a match involved.
Yeah, what started it? Yeah. Something has to set that reaction off, and looking at that, and that's it's a brilliant. It's a brilliant idea to go into it and pick apart and work on.
Yeah.
You got that, John? They want to see you at open mic night. And which leads right to Eric from Wilmington, who wants to know if comedians could be considered modern day philosophers.
I feel like I'm still trying to figure this out myself. Like, what is a comic? But, you know, I think that we kind of keep things in balance a little bit. You know, there's people thinking one way, and then there's people over here thinking another way, and then the comic gets on stage and kind of just talks about it. Mm-hmm. And it kind of keeps – it either keeps you on the path you're on, or it helps bring us together, or it helps separate us. But it's constantly kind of moving and shifting. That's the art form. It's like the moving and shifting of the spoken word.
And Anonymous is asking about the current climate regarding Me Too and existing racism, which we kind of addressed. But they're asking, how long should a comedian be penalized for an indiscretion, be it sexual or a racial slur on stage? Lou Morganti.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to judge that, because there is no comedy human resources. Like, there's not like a building that has human resources where it's all set up, right? So we don't know. And, you know, the thing is, there's the separation of the art versus the person. There's a lot of people, like you brought up the Aziz Ansari thing. You know, that was an offstage indiscretion that he had, right? So it wasn't something that he said on stage. I mean, he talks about it in his recent special, things like that. So what is it? And who gets to judge that? And that's where it comes down to. It really comes down to what the audience members do. Are they going to pay money to support that person in their art form? We see a lot, you know, there's certain, you know, comedians now that have, you know, had discretions.
Louis C.K.,
right? He has, you know, and there's, you know, he's not going to jail. He's not paying any fines. He took some time away, and he decided to come back. People are buying tickets to those shows. So what can you say now? You know, did I find Louis C.K.'s humor funny? Yes. Do I find what he did abhorrent? Yeah. Would I pay money now to go see him? Probably not. That's not just what I'm into at that
point. Yeah, me either.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Timmy, Cheryl, Lou Morganti, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.